This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Being frightened, heart-pounding, adrenaline-pumping, cold sweat fear, not an enjoyable experience, except when it is. Just look at the popularity of haunted houses, horror films, and novels. People like a good scare under the right circumstances. With us this Halloween to take a look at why so many of us seek out things that frighten us are Miami University psychology professor Dr. Elizabeth Keel, Gary Vaughn, associate professor of English at the University of Cincinnati's McMicken College of Arts and Science, and joining us from Pittsburgh Public Radio, WESA, Dr. Margie Kerr, a sociologist at the University of Pittsburgh and Chatham University, who studies the science of fear. And Dr. Kerr is an advisor for Scare House in Pittsburgh, which has been ranked as one of America's scariest Halloween attractions by the Travel Channel. Thanks, everybody, for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Margie, you call yourself a sociologist who studies fear. Now, why did you end up going in that specific direction with your research?
Well, I have been working on the study of in and out group preferences and basically trying to understand how fear had been working in society to keep people apart. When I went to Scare House in 2008, I just started thinking about fear from a different perspective and, you know, really questioning how people were enjoying fear and how it was benefiting people rather than focusing on the more kind of divisive nature of it.
So is it fair to say that you enjoy being scared? Because didn't you actually try some scary things as part of your research?
Yeah, this past year I have done as many scary and thrilling things as I possibly can. Across the world, I went to Japan and Colombia, Canada, trying to do just as many different types of thrills and chills to see what it felt like from a personal perspective, since I had been looking at it much more from an academic perspective for so long.
Elizabeth, what exactly happens in our brains when we're scared? It's all a big chemical reaction, isn't it?
That's right. We can think about our brains as having a kind of alarm system that tells us immediately if there's something threatening or dangerous in our environment. And that can set off other parts of our biology as well, so that rapid heartbeat that you feel when you're scared.
So this is kind of a natural high, so to speak. I mean, dopamine's involved, I think, in a lot of different chemicals like that.
Exactly. It's a very complex process, but a very adaptive one as well.
Is this a form of thrill seeking, or is there something more to it than this?
It can be. So as you said, under the right circumstances, if we know we're not actually in harm's way, that increased reaction, the rapid heartbeat, that can be exciting or thrilling.
So, Margie, essentially, we like being scared because it's fun, especially if it's a low-risk, controlled setting, correct?
Yeah, if we know that we're safe, we can enjoy it. We can kind of hijack that threat response and you know, just enjoy the physical aspects of it. But then also, it does make us feel confident afterwards. Even though we know we're in a safe spot, that we're not really fighting a horde of zombies, we can come out the other side feeling like we really did. And it can be a really nice self-esteem boost, help you build that sense of resilience, and just kind of make you feel like you can take on any challenge.
I find that intriguing. It's a confidence builder, right, Liz?
Mm-hmm.
And Martin, so it really is? Gary's shaking his head.
Yes.
Is that what you found in your writing and your study?
Yes, I think a lot of that is true. It's survival. You are in a one-up position if you survive these horrible things that are happening around you. And, of course, we as viewers, and I'm thinking now of narrative modes, the aesthetics of horror, movies and books and short stories and so forth. When we, via the characters involved in the story, survive the monsters that are pursuing us, we get to feel superior to the monsters themselves and to, of course, the other characters that don't survive.
From Dracula to Stephen King novels, Gary, people really mm-hmm. really do enjoy scary stories.
Mm-hmm.
So the joy of fear has always been something that's been present in our society, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And that raises some interesting questions, like how can we be afraid of something that we know does not exist, like Dracula? And why are we attracted to something like horror, which is seen as a negative, you know, emotion that we normally wouldn't want to have? And I think a partial answer to that is we're attracted to the things we know don't exist, because it's the thought, not the reality, but the thought of the possibility in this imaginative make-believe world that they could exist. And of course, it's the fascination of reading about horror-inducing, quote-unquote, events that thrills us and kind of compensates for the negative feelings.
Liz, did you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. And I think we see that in kids as well. So even from a very early age, it's a way to learn about their world and a way for them to feel some control over it as well.
So is there evidence that kids enjoy being scared like adults do?
Some of them do. I think that depends both on age as well as on their personalities. So we know that when kids get to about age 10 or so, we do see kind of a shift. They're moving away from things like having imaginary friends or ascribing human characteristics to objects, things like that. And they can also engage in more sophisticated ways of thinking about things. But children are also going to vary, just like as we do as adults, how enjoyable they find those things, too.
So some kids will really like it, some kids will really hate it, and likewise, some adults will really enjoy it, and some adults, they just won't.
Exactly.
Is that because of the way we're born, or is that something that we learn that and acquire mm-hmm. it as we go along?
I think it's an interaction of those things. We are born with certain biologies. We may have different sensitivities in that alarm system that tells us about threat in our environment, where that alarm isn't going to go off as easily for some kids, so they enjoy those things, whereas for others, it may go off really easily. So even in situations that aren't threatening but are just more uncertain. So I think biology definitely has a role in that, but it also depends on what they're learning in their environment as well.
Margie, what kind of work do you do exactly for Scarehouse? You're studying the sociology of fear. How does that apply to what you do there?
Well, I look at a lot of their customer response data, and I try and find out what the customers are saying they find scary, and looking for trends over the past, I guess, 6 years now, to see what direction the population is going, what they want more of, what they want less of. And then I share that information with the designers, and they take it and turn it into new monsters, different kinds of sets. And it's nice. I can kind of share with them, you know, what the customers want, but then add another layer of kind of the science of what's happening in a person's body when they're afraid, to help them make a kind of a symphony of scares, so that when people walk through the haunted house, they're not just being, you know, inundated with the same type of scare over and over, but different types, trying to impact different types of scares, whether it's psychological or just a startle scare, you know, an air cannon versus a, you know, person kind of coming up and talking to you. So that's where I can contribute. I'm not much of a designer, but I can share with them what people want.
Do you ever play the role of fly on the wall, and you just look, you watch for and record the reactions of people as they go through the scare house?
Oh, absolutely. That's my favorite thing to do. We have all of these peepholes throughout the entire haunt, and they're mostly made for security so that they can watch the customers and make sure they're not touching things. But I like to just stay in the same place, you know, all night and watch all of the different customer reactions. And then the next night I'll go to a new spot and just see how people react, different types of people, how men versus women, older folks versus children, and just kind of make notes and then see how we can improve upon that to make it a good experience for everybody.
And all the research you've done, you ever have something that really surprised you about the way people reacted?
I think probably the thing that you don't see a lot, and that I've only ever seen once, is someone actually freezing. You know, you hear about people running or, you know, trying to fight back, but there are a few people who will just stop dead in their tracks. And I've only seen it in person once, where the woman just, she wouldn't move. She just would not move forward. And we had to go in and, you know, kind of shake her a little bit and say, are you okay? Are you still here? But that's a reaction that I don't see very often.
Can you expand on this a little bit, Elizabeth, talking about the overall mood of a population and individuals being scared. For example, War of the Worlds aired when people were worried about war after 1911. Maybe, Gary, you can weigh in, too, since you're our author, philosophical type here. But how does that all flow together? How does that work?
Sure. Well, we know that sometimes fear can be contagious. So when we see our family members or friends being scared about something, we start to think, oh, maybe I should be scared of that too. And I think even kids pick up on that more behaviorally. They're going to feed off those reactions. So it can spread, certainly when we're all focused on something scary and kind of scaring ourselves more and more.
I think cultures tend to objectify their fears through narration and entertainment. So if you think back to the 50s, for instance, what was going on then? Fear of communism. So we get movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, our bodies being taken over by alien forces trying to control our minds. Or think of all those movies that you name the insect, and because of some nuclear accident or fallout or whatever, it becomes gigantic and threatening. And I think you can say the same thing about current shows like The Walking Dead, American Horror Story Coven. I think my take on The Walking Dead is, well, zombies in general more recently, I think it's a response to the economic problems we're having with the recession a few years ago. So we became frightened by losing jobs, prospect of losing jobs or our homes, credit problems and so forth. And so it's easy to think of ourselves as being overwhelmed, being eaten by the problems surrounding us. And I think the zombie phenomena has a lot to do with that.
You wrote a story titled Interview with the Zombie. And I like the title, by the way. Interview sounds like Interview with a Vampire.
Yes.
Anyway, one of the questions that you ask the zombie is, so humans are fascinated by the alternatively alive because they represent a way for us to regain a sense of control over our lives and to deal with a reality as we see as unpleasant.
Yes.
So what's the zombie tell you?
The zombie that I interviewed, by the way, he was a former banker in the real world, the live world. He came up with the idea alternatively alive because he doesn't like the term zombie. He was talking about how human nature causes us to want to separate ourselves or to separate others from us, out groups versus in groups. And his take on it was that we kind of want to blame something for what happens to us, that there are things we don't like in the environment around us, in the culture. And so things like economics, what's happening to us through the economy, through loss of jobs, potential loss of jobs, and so forth, comes out to stalk us. It's like that old childhood game, I think it's called Tag or sometimes It, where I used to play this on the school ground a lot, where somebody would be designated it and run around and try to tag other people, and then they would become other its trying to wipe out the population. That's pretty much what zombieism is, I think.
Liz, does the zombie have a valid point?
Maybe so. I might have to defer to some of my colleagues at Miami who study these things a little bit more explicitly than I do. But I think that, you know, it really is about kind of gaining control. And even if it is just kind of how we're thinking about things, thinking that we have control.
Mm-hmm. Margie, do you agree with that? Do you think that this applies to fear? It's a way for us to regain that sense of control and deal with life's unpleasantries?
Yeah, I do. I think especially when you do something like riding a roller coaster or watching a scary movie, you are bringing all of those concerns, those future kind of anxieties right into your grasp. You know that something is going to come to a resolution within hours, and it does give some nice closure to it and that feeling of control over uncertainty, over the unknown.
Margie, there are all kinds of early examples that you studied of people scaring themselves on purpose. What are some of those?
Well, you can find stories of, you know, tribes coming together to tell, you know, tales about the monsters and the beasts that they would meet out in the wild from pretty much the dawn of man. And it was very functional. You know, we would tell these stories as a way to create group solidarity, to bring people together against a common enemy. You know, we still do that today. It was also a great form of social control. As many parents know, if you want to keep your kids out of the basement, you just tell them that's where the boogeyman was. So, you know, scaring each other has been with us for a very long time. And I think, you know, even back then, people were doing it because there was that excitement, the anticipation, and eventual kind of fun that came from it. So you can use it in a functional way, but also this very enjoyable way. And today we've just, I think, really refined how to achieve that natural high and also the confidence boost in a very controlled environment that's of our own choosing, and engage with it really whenever we want to.
So the new aspect is that we pay now to be scared. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm trying to find lots of ways that you can do it for free, whether it's just, you know, popping out from behind a door to scare your mom. But, yeah, some of the best thrills and chills are definitely a high ticket price, which is sad because, you know, I wish everyone could go and jump out of a plane because it does feel amazing.
Wow. I can't imagine.
I think control is really the key word.
Yes.
Here. Traditionally, in horror stories and films, they follow the sort of standard plot of here's normal life, here's the introduction of something abnormal, chaos results, and then the normal is reasserted and regains ground, regains control. Along those lines, I have a short quote from Stephen King that I think is very revealing. He said, "Monstrosity fascinates us because it appeals to the conservative Republican in a three-piece suit who resides within all of us. We love and need the concept of monstrosity because it is a reaffirmation of the order we all crave as human beings. And let me further suggest that it is not the physical or mental aberration in itself which horrifies us, but rather the lack of order which these situations seem to imply."
Did you want to weigh in on that?
Sure,
Liz?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think sometimes we see that type of thing, you know, with the kids who are going trick-or-treating out tonight. What are they dressed up as? But all of these horrible things. And if they can embody those things, it makes it less scary.
Margie, in your studies, have you found that enjoying fear is something that varies across cultures, or does it have the same universal elements wherever you go?
I have found that it varies. When I was in Japan, I saw that there were so many different ways that the communities were engaging with scary material, whether it was with the haunted houses, which they do have a big haunted house industry, though theirs is in the summertime because they go to a haunted house to cool down because it gives you chills, which I think is really genius. But they also have, you know, scary themed restaurants and bars and ghost tours, and just across the board, a lot of very entertaining, engaging, scary activities. When I was in Colombia, in Bogota, I saw that there really were not as many scary activities available. They don't really have a haunted house industry. The horror movies don't do very well. The TV shows that are more in the horror genre don't get the same high ratings as comedies or love stories. And so right now I'm working on developing a typology, trying to understand the relationship between actual safety of a society and that society's engagement with scary or thrilling material. Tokyo, Japan, is very safe. Colombia has a fairly recent history of lots of political conflict and lots of very real threats to personal safety. So I think that there is a relationship there between the safety of a society and its engagement with scary material. I don't think it's quite as linear as I would like, because you've got lots of cases where there is a society with high rates of actual violence and high engagement with scary material. But I think that there is something to this. So I'm trying to figure that relationship out right now.
Margie, since you're in search of fear, do you have a fear that you don't want to face?
Right now, you know, I really can't think of a fear that I don't want to face. Now, I very much am curious to find out what other things I'm afraid of. I did find out through this past year that I'm afraid of things I didn't think that I was, like heights. So now it's just kind of opened a door to self-discovery where I want to expose myself to as many scary things as possible to see how I'm going to react.
Gary, what about you?
I think my art horror fear factor would be an imaginary scenario in which I have 4 root canals performed by ex-girlfriends dressed like clowns while Calliope music is playing.
That sounds like a Stephen King novel.
Yeah, I should write that.
You should. Liz, what about you?
Should I not say being on live radio?
No, you've done fine. Mine would be heights. I'm with you, Margie. Heights still bother me to this day. So we'd like to say thanks to all of you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Margie, we'll be hearing from you again this afternoon. You're on Science Friday, right, during the 3 o'clock hour?
That's right, yep.
Okay, look forward to it.
Thank you.
Miami University psychology professor Dr. Elizabeth Kiel, Gary Vaughn, associate professor of English at the University of Cincinnati's McMicken College of Arts and Science, and Dr. Margie Kerr, a sociologist at the University of Pittsburgh and Chatham University.